session number 10704, reel 2.
Captain Harris, reel 1.
What was the response of the Singaporeans to you as you marched to Channing?
Well, very, very different. I thought that as they had depended so much for so long on the British, that they would feel very let down. They must have felt very let down. But they stood really, all, as I can remember, for several miles. The streets were lined 2 and 3, 5 deep. People looking at us, I suppose, from curiosity, probably in sadness, probably wondering what the heck was going to happen to them when this lot, these white men, were put into the prisoner camps that we were walking to, marching to. I could hardly call it marching, actually. We were a pretty rough, shambling lot. But there wasn't any cheering, but people kept on running out and pushing cigarettes, tinned food of all descriptions, even butter, I remember, and what we didn't know at the time, pig oil in cans, and more than we could really carry. It was, I suppose we would probably be loaded down. We just had one nip guard, that's all we had, taking us, and we walked all the way to Changi, where, you know, the big cantonment where the British fortress troops, well, some of them were, and there where the big military hospital was, the Roberts Hospital block, that was mainly the place. And they put us and with the rest into the, what we call the coconut grove. Some of the more fortunate people were put into the barracks, you know, very, very crowded. The coconut grove is existed where the present airport runway and the reclaimed land at the famous international Singapore International Airport was built on it. When I went back to Singapore in, I suppose it would be about 1970, for the first time, no, it would be, I'd probably been several times since on business, because I used to go to the dry dockings of ships there. And but in 1970, I had the privilege of meeting Mr. Lee Kuan Yew, who was, of course, the Prime Minister. And I told him about that experience. I was very moved. So we got into these, well, they were sort of old plantations, kampongs, little villages that all the villages had been cleared out, and they gave us tents, and some of the lads managed to build coverings and so forth and so on, and we landed there and we had a pretty thin time of it as far as food was concerned. But the nips didn't bother us at all. They were too busy, I suppose, doing other things. But gradually, all the men that were there were siphoned off into working parties. Of course, I was wounded, and one of my arms was in a plaster, and it was in a plaster for about 9 months altogether. And I can tell you, I was even my best friends didn't really like coming near me because it had a terrible pong, this left arm of mine. Anyway, we were there, or I was there, until March 1943. And Changi was an amazing place. We saw very little of the nips. The climate was quite pleasant, apart from the belting rain that used to come very regularly, I think in the evenings, around about 6 o'clock. We had little food. I mean, some of the stories that I could tell you, time doesn't permit, about how we managed to eke it out Really quite remarkable. People suffered terribly from beriberi and pellagra. Fellows went blind, you know, with a lack of vitamins. And we had this awful changi bollocks, which was a tinea around the scrotum. That was a very painful thing. And the other, the worst thing of all, was what was known as happy feet. People couldn't get to sleep because their feet... It's not exactly an ache, it was a sort of burning, hot sensation, and you couldn't get to sleep. And they had a pretty rough time, really, most of the people there. But we had a university was set up, and I know I learnt a lot about this and that, particularly early English history. And it was a wonderful show. It was all very well organized. We had great football teams. Our battalion, the recce of the 5th Loyals, had a wonderful football team. We are pretty well about the best on the bunch. And we used to play these competitive matches. And we used to idle away our time when the working parties had gone off to Singapore. We had to look after the camp and that sort of thing. The only untoward thing that I remember, and we, by God, I've never forgotten it. God, I haven't. Were the Sikhs who turned over to the Japs, the IRA, the Free Indian Army, I think they used to call themselves, and they were very nasty to, I think, all the white British troops, but most particularly to their own white officers. Used to make them bow down in the road and salute them and treat them very, very badly. I never forgotten that about the Sikhs. Not much sympathy for the Sikhs, not really. Not racist, but I remember that very well.
Were all the Indian defectors Sikhs?
Oh, no. The vast majority would be Punjabis and Dogras and ordinary men that were in the Indian Army, and they didn't have any much choice, really. They were coloured men, and the Japanese, of course, come to free them of the white yoke or white raj or what have you. There were the only troops that were absolutely adamant as far as resistance to the Japanese were concerned were the Gurkhas. The Gurkhas, they couldn't do anything with the Gurkhas. The Gurkhas were very loyal, if you could call it that, but they certainly didn't want to be part of the greater... What was it? Greater East Asia co-prosperity sphere.
But was it the Sikhs who behaved particularly odiously?
Oh, yes. Only the Sikhs. Yes. Oh, yes. Only the Sikhs. Anyhow, in March 43... well, I think probably in June 1943, the first people were going up to Thailand. I don't know whether they knew what they were going to, but certainly one or two members of our battalion, including Lieutenant Higginson, Bernard Higginson, they went up very early on in parties of probably, I don't know, how, maybe as small as 50s, but they were gradually shunted up the peninsula to Thailand, where first of all these first parties helped to survey and take out the, what do they call it, the line of the railway through the jungle. But then parties of 550 men and five officers kept on going up from Singapore railway station right up to, I think, about April, May of 43, and then that was the first lot. They sort of stopped then, and we all went up to build a railway, and we went up in these cattle trucks. I think it was 34 to a truck. Very unpleasant, really, because you could hardly sit down, and it was very, very hot. You know, they hardly let us out. At least that's my remembrance of it. And then finally we got to Bangkok, I suppose it would be, or Bampong, a railway junction. And we were then transferred to open trucks and taken to a place called Camburi.
Did you think that you were going off to somewhere better?
Oh, we were told we were going to great camps. You could bring everything you wanted, including pianos. And everybody went up there absolutely loaded with kit. I wasn't particularly loaded with it, except that I did carry three big books. James Joyce's Ulysses, Arthur Bryant's book on the social history, English Saga, and Emil Ludwig's Napoleon. Those were the books that I carried up. But every officer, other men may have carried them up too, but every officer was bound to carry up books. So they all came from the famous Raffles Library. And gradually, over the next year or two, of course, they were mostly lost. I certainly didn't bring back any books from being a prisoner of war. But there was a tremendous range of books. I mean, for example, in the last year that I was up there, when the railway had been finished, I used to read books like Aldous Huxley's, Grey Eminence, Winwood Reade, Marcus Aurelius. We had a lot of time to talk and think, well, certainly amongst the officers. As far as officers are concerned, on the railway, officers really had to work like coolies, like everybody else. I don't think they ever had such a bad time as the other ranks. It's an amazing thing to think that in a camp of probably perhaps 2,000 men, there might be perhaps 200 officers. The officers were in their own huts, and what went on in the men's huts was really very private to the men. The officers, very, very few officers. I've learned a lot since I came back, but what the men did in those long nights, well, I suppose they were so damned exhausted from the work that they were had to do. I mean, they had a fearful time. I only saw them coming back, and I only saw them going out, and I only had the experience of getting men out onto parade and with other officers trying to protect the 200 or so men that the NIPS would allow us to keep back who were really desperately ill. But all these men were ill. They were all suffering from malnutrition, and an enormous number of them suffered from, if not dysentery, diarrhea, beriberi, you know, all the avitaminosis diseases. And they were out at the crack of bloody dawn, and they didn't get back till, you know, it was a long, long, long day, and they were worn out. And I suppose that when they came back and had what little food there was available, and I was in charge of cooking at certainly one camp, two camps that I'll never forget. And, you know, what we had to give them was rice. You could measure it in pints, pint in the morning, pint at night. That's rice. We tried to do things with rice, frying it in oil and mixing it up with jungle vegetables. We had jungle stews. You know, you used to have sometimes, if we're lucky, we had one beast, one water buffalo, I think they mostly were, between, say, 1,000 men. They used to say they used to just drag it through the water. That helped a little bit to give some taste. We were fortunate enough to get salt and local purchasing from Thai boats that came up the river to augment supplies, carried things like coconut oil, palm oil, pig fat, jungle vegetables, tobacco, hag's bush we used to call it, very horrible tobacco really. That used to be in, I think they used to sell them in catties. That was a measurement of weight that the Thais had. The men used to get paid, I think it was 10 cents a day. If it was any more than that, I would be surprised. Some of them wouldn't be paid at all. The officers were supposed to get $200 a month, and we got $30 a month. $10 we were allowed to keep, and $20 were put into a kitty for buying food. Not for the officers, for the camp. That happened certainly in the camps that I was in. Whether it happened everywhere, I don't know, but certainly in the camps that I was in, because a lot of our own fellows, you see, we were all, we knew each other, and there was no sort of division. I mean, all right, we still had the authority as officers, and in my experience, I never had anybody. I had anybody at all ever tell me to fuck off.
In some of the books that I've read, the authors have made the claim that if a unit managed to preserve itself intact, the officers and men in that unit had a better time than those units which were broken up. Is there any truth to that from your own experience?
Oh, I would think most certainly. Yes, I would think so. But I think that the memories that I have that stick with me more than anything else, and they might surprise some people, but I remember the way in which the Australians were very conscious and proud of the fact that they were Australians, and they had certainly got a great camaraderie. I don't think we particularly liked Australians. We noticed it certainly with the Dutch, a lot of Dutch. The Dutch could beat us at our own game. You know, they were great individualists. And the British, the great thing about the ordinary British Tommy was when things were really bad, they were the only people that could laugh and sing. They really were quite remarkable. I think this is a great thing about the British. You know, they can, when things are really bad, they come up trumps. And, yes, I remember that very well.
Yeah. We hear about the ill treatment by the Japanese or Korean guards.
Yeah.
Did you personally suffer any punishments from them?
I was only beaten about 3 times, and not very badly. But I mean, God, blimey, there were some terrible beatings. But I was very lucky, I think, principally because I was mostly involved with cooking. And I think a lot of people had known that I was wounded, and I'd been taken prisoner of war in that way and not had to surrender. I was taken prisoner of war because I couldn't defend myself, and that helped. Well, I know it did, because I only worked half a day on the railway. That was at Whampoa, on the viaduct at Whampoa. And I was taken off by a little nip shouting, I don't know what the hell was going to happen to me, and anyhow, the upshot of it all was that I was given an armband, and what it said on this armband was that I had been taken prisoner of war after being wounded. And the nip who had brought me up in the party must have known about this when I was in Singapore. So I had no work on the railway, and I can't speak about the work on the railway except from hearsay.
So why were you punished?
Well, I can't. It would be very trivial. You might have a lot of fellows carrying sacks up for sacks of rice, 12-pound sacks of rice up from the barges. And, one or two of them might have had enough and put the bloody things down. And I'd be there, and I'd be the shoko. And then the private soldier would shout and bang and shout, you know, and I'd say to these fellows, for Christ's sake, pick these bloody sacks up, I'm going to be beaten if you don't. And sure enough, yeah, beaten. But they used to beat you with split bamboos. They used to split the end of the bamboo, and they used to beat you by trying to hit you across the face, and it was very painful if they got a hold of you. But they could never hit you. They were no good at... they didn't know how to use themselves. I mean, to a fellow standing up, not supposed to be defending himself, I mean, you could ride any punches. I never had any real beatings, but, I mean, I know people that certainly had some real beatings.
What's a shirko?
That's the Japanese for an officer.
Did you come across any of the Japanese or guards who were more humane?
No, I never met any of the little bastards who were humane. Well, perhaps I was lucky. There are people that say that, you know, you had a chap who was a Christian, you had chaps who were more venal than others, they're very corruptible. All these lads could probably tell you, you could always bribe a Japanese if you got the chance or had the wherewithal. No, I didn't meet any humane Japanese. There might have been some. They're not all, they can't be all bad, but...
Did you witness any executions?
No.
Or hear of any?
Oh, yes.
What did you hear of executions?
Oh, only one or two, and there were hearsay rumours of how people had had their heads chopped off, but these lads will know more about it than I do. But there were fellows put into cages for being suspect running wirelesses and all that sort of thing. I mean, the last camp that I was in, a fellow called Drawer, he was put in a cage because of something to do with wireless, and he wouldn't tell them anything, and he had a terrible, terrible time. I think he nearly died if he didn't die. But it's a funny thing. I don't remember a hell of a lot about what happened now. It's sort of very broad and general. But the thing that I do remember most of all were the troops coming back at night. Absolutely buggered. And they were so driven. It's hard to... unless people were there, it's hard to understand how any human being could drive another human being in the way that those fellows were driven, particularly on what they call the speedos. And it was terrible weather some of the time, you know, rain all day, wasn't it? All were rain day in, day out, and you never dry, never, always wet. But it wasn't all bad. They used to have quite a bit of fun.
Do you remember any particular individuals who stood out on the railway, who any particular personalities who did things for the troops?
Oh, yes, indeed. Some of the, most particularly the territorial senior officers, people like Colonel Toosey, Colonel Knight, Colonel Lilly, they were terrific chaps. They really were. A lot of officers are very good, but a lot of officers, well, I mean, it's the same as you get everywhere. More good than bad, but when they were bad, they were bad. But when they were good, some of them were exceptionally good. Very brave men.
Any particular medical people or
priests? Yes, doctors almost without exception. Fantastic. Absolutely wonderful, the doctors. Of all the medical branches, whether they were English, Dutch, American, Canadian, doctors were absolutely fantastic. They really were.
You were telling me earlier about the various kinds of work which the officers were doing. Can you repeat that on tape?
Oh, well, the only work that I remember was when we came down into what we call the banana and omelette belt. After the railway was finished, they had to find something for us to do, and I suppose in a way we were grateful to be found something to do. But The only work that I remember, and I remember it with some fun really, because it was a bit of a laugh. When we were, they separated the officers from the men, I think it was towards the end of 1944, and the men were left in this huge great camp at Tam Wang, and we were moved, about 2,000 officers were moved to Kamburi, to the it's the sort of main town west of Bangkok, very close to where the bridge over the Kwai Noi was built, and you know where the bombings and all that sort of thing took place, and where there is a big cemetery today, and it was opposite an old paper mill. Well, it wouldn't be an old paper mill, it would be a bloody good new paper mill, probably built by Scandinavians, I think, in Thailand before the war. And I was a member of a working party which is known as the Textile Working Party. We used to spend our mornings scraping banana leaves, you know, the stems of banana leaves, and scraping out the fibre. It's all fibre. And, of course, we had cotton people who were with us, people like David Molyneux, who was our second-in-command, people from Yorkshire, Harry Whiteley, I remember, Clegg, Major Clegg. They were all to do with textiles. And although I had nothing to do with textiles, they were pals of mine. We used to scrape these stems from banana plants and extract these long, coarse fibres. And these blokes that knew something about the trade actually built a loom. And it was a bit like, what's the wife of Ulysses? Penelope. You know, she was knitting a scarf or something, wasn't she? And each night she used to undo it. The idea was that if the scarf was finished, she'd give it to the chap who she was going to marry, or who'd marry her when, as her husband hadn't returned. Span it out. Well, I don't think that we were able to unravel the weaving that was done. But there was some weaving done, but we had a great difficulty in providing the twist, you know, the fibre for doing it. Then there was a working party for the gardens. Used to collect the urine from the ends of the huts and used to mix it, I think it was 10-1 with water. And that used to be poured between the tomato plants or whatever it was that was in the garden. We used to have a very excellent scientific laboratory sort of working party, mainly staffed by Dutch, actually. I remember a Shell chemist called Bakker, B-A-K-E-R, and they made, from distillation